Welcome to the Compassionate Leaders Circle podcast. For thousands of years, the sages have known that compassion is a powerful force for good. In the last two decades, compassion scholars caught up with these sages, proving that there is an ROI to building loving communities and businesses. This podcast features leaders who can teach us about the power of compassion. Welcome, Jeff Wald, to the podcast. I'm so happy to have you here today. I was excited to meet you a few weeks ago before the world changed. And here we are today on November 11th. I'm just so grateful to be with you and welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It is such an honor to be here.
I was doing some reading. I didn't read your book because I was stuck on cable news, but I was doing some reading about you. And I didn't really want to introduce you because you're so many men and so many things, but I am curious about a couple of things that came up and in our conversation. I'm really curious about your first book, The Birthday Rules, right? Is that what it's called?
That is what it's called.
And being a member of the New York City Police Auxiliary. So could you... talk about those two things, and then we'll talk about your other things.
Well, I will do them in order. So The Birthday Rules was my first book, and it's a guide for raising children written by somebody that has no children and has no, you know, advanced degrees in developmental psychology or things like that. The idea came to me, Laurel, while at Thanksgiving, I mean, shoot, maybe 8 years ago now, when my older brother and his wife, who were the two best humans I know, of all the people I've interacted with and all the people I've had the chance to meet all over this amazing world, these are the two most wonderful, kind, compassionate, thoughtful, interesting. I mean, they're just the best people. And they've got three wonderful, beautiful, thoughtful children. And at Thanksgiving, they were lamenting because their oldest, Jonah, had asked for a phone. Jonah was 7 at the time. And my older brother and his wife didn't know what to do. They were truly lost. And my older brother made, you know, one of those throwaway comments. He just said, you know, someone should just write a list of when kids get what, and all parents have to follow it. And, you know, he meant it jokingly. And I thought to myself, that's actually not a bad idea. And so I hired some researchers and we put together what developmental psychologists the world over say about what is the appropriate age from a child's development standpoint as to when they get a phone and social media accounts and a host of other things. And look, it wasn't designed to be a, you know, prescription, because every child's developmental path is different. Every family's value system is different. Every family's economic capabilities are different. Just because your kid's in theory ready for a phone in terms of the development of their prefrontal cortex doesn't mean you can afford a phone. Maybe your kid takes the bus and you want him to have a phone before he's developmentally ready for the phone. All good. This is designed as a framework, a fun and flexible framework for raising children in a technology era. I was able to get Dr. Rachel Marsh, who leads Columbia University's Brain Imaging Laboratory and is one of the world's experts. But truth be told, between you, I, and of course your listeners, she's actually my younger sister-in-law. So still keeping in the family. And so that was the first book, which was great. I mean, we had a lot of fun with it, you know, sold a couple thousand copies of the book. It was fun, but, you know, definitely a nice little side project. The auxiliary units of the NYPD was a way for me to serve. And I always carried this regret that I'm the first generation in my family that hasn't served this country or the country they lived in. My family came here a couple of generations ago. And actually, this wasn't even planned because I know you were asked that. I wear my dad's dog tag. Like, this is all very important to me. I remember my dad saying to me when I was going off to college, you should just be aware, Jeffrey, that you are not going to be asked to give your 2 years to this country. You should be aware that every other person in your family has done that prior to you. And just be thankful you live in a generation where that's not required of you. And I am super thankful that I live in a generation at a point in history where that kind of service is not required of us. But it doesn't mean that service is not required of us. And I'm a big proponent of a national service mandate for children as they're developing, for young adults. And I've certainly done my share of volunteer work and charity donations and things like that, but it still struck me as insufficient. And so when I learned that the NYPD had a program that is similar to the Army Reserves, where twice a month you can come and go on patrol. I mean, you have to be trained, and the training is about 100 hours. You go to the police academy, and then you get to serve your community. And putting on that uniform, because for those of your listeners that live in New York City, you have seen auxiliary officers hundreds, if not thousands of times. Most people don't know the difference, though. They just see a man or woman in blue, and those men and women in blue put their lives on the line. And the auxiliary officers are not nearly as putting their lives on the line as a regular officer, but it is something that you can do as a member of your community to serve in the common safety of the community, the common defense of the community. And it was a great thing. I did it for the better part of 10 years. I enjoyed it thoroughly. And I lament from time to time that I am no longer active and in service with the NYPD.
What did you learn about your city and police work from that job?
From that Through that job and through many other interactions with the police department over the years, I've learned, you know, 99.999% of the time, the men and women in uniform get it right. They do the right thing in incredibly difficult circumstances. And the problem, of course, in their job is that 0.001% time, someone might lose life. A life might be taken, and it's horrifying. But I've also learned that the average person in that circumstance would make most of the time the exact same mistake. And I do qualify most of them as mistakes, not all of them, but most of them are mistakes. And I've been in police training simulators where I've shot civilians, and I've been in circumstances in real life, not in a simulator, where I've been scared out of my mind and so fearful for my own safety. And the idea that I was going to do the exact right thing is laughable. And granted, I don't have as much training as an officer and things like that, but the idea that we expect, or anyone might expect, because I shouldn't say we, the idea that anyone would expect perfection from these officers is not a fair expectation. And the admiration I have for them rises every time I think about my experience, every time I put on that uniform, that these were men and women that were imperfect, that were not given them the perfect training or the perfect equipment, but they went out every day to do their level best to keep the society safe. And their job is much more difficult than I ever thought it was.
Well, and I appreciate you really putting yourself in their shoes, literally. What a great vantage point to have. And as we face everything we have to face around police work, I think your voice is really important, and your vantage point is really important. So one of the many reasons I was excited to speak to you is because in my work, I often have this privilege of talking to leaders and executives and entrepreneurs when they're in the hallway, whether they're between ventures or they're retiring, or sometimes privately we have conversations when they're leading something they don't believe in and they have to figure that out. We've talked about you being in the hallway. Could you talk about your situation a little bit and what you've been up to since September?
Sure. So first off, I loved when you and I spoke before and you talked about it as in the hallway. I've reflected on that a lot since, and it's a wonderful visual as you're going from one part, one adventure, and you're going to the hallway and you're looking in different doors and seeing, is this where I'm going to take my next few years? So look, I was so blessed to build this company called Work Market and sell it to ADP. And on September 25th, I had my last day at ADP, and it was wonderful. I did cry a lot. And then on September 26th, I went full-time with the Biden campaign. I did that because this was just a cause that was so important to me, because I felt that the institutions of the United States were fundamentally being attacked by one individual. And so I don't disagree with President Trump and everything that he's done, by the way. I can talk to your listeners about things that I think that he did over the last 4 years that were great, but there were on balance many more things in my mind that were negative And therefore, given that I had the time, I spent that entire period up through Election Day working for the Biden campaign. And it was a great experience, but it was, you know, a very small task. It was a very brief walk out of the hallway. But as I think about my time now, and I've given myself a couple months to not try to look in each door, not try to think too much, but just to take this time and reflect and to really be mindful about which next door I open, because when you open that door, it is a very serious intent. You should go into it with a very serious intent and with the intent that you're going to be there for a couple years. And I think a part of my instinct is at least is to try to go into multiple doors at the same time. And I'm trying to fight that. There are some nonprofit that I'd like to start. There are two or three other companies that I'm thinking about starting. I'm talking with some firms about joining their firm. And that is such a gift to have all those different choices, but it requires a lot of reflection. So I've given myself until the end of Q1 to really think and take a break for the first time in a long time, and to think a lot about the insecurities that I'm feeling as I try to pick that next door, because I don't want me to pick the door that has the least amount of fear in it. Because I'm afraid that I may do that and just pick the easiest path. And I want to pick the thing that is going to help me live my highest purpose in life. And, you know, too many times we give into fear. And I think fear becomes very present when you're in the hallway, because the hallway can be scary, because, and sometimes that fear is you have too many choices. And that's a good problem to have. But sometimes it is, oh no, what if I never get out of the hallway? What if this is the last journey that I take, the last time I have to impact? And so I've thought a lot about this, not obviously in a very cogent way, as that was not the most cogent delivery of the answer to your question, but I think mostly about the fear that I have about being in the hallway and the fear about the decision and not letting fear be the overriding deciding factor.
Well, thank you for being so honest. I think we often gloss over this period in a person's life. And sometimes if it's a person who has sold a company and lives well, we imagine that person is just happy, right? So I appreciate, talk to me a little bit about the tears when you sold your company.
Well, and just to be clear, I am extraordinarily happy in addition to having all of these fears and all these other things. And I am extraordinarily grateful.
Yeah.
And very mindful of how hard I've worked, but also how lucky I was.
Yeah.
And a lot of these things. Look, the tears were tears of joy. You know, the emails that came in from men and women that had worked at that company that I had a chance to work with, that maybe used our service, and the fact that we had built this company helped them advance their careers and put more money in their pockets and develop themselves. Those emails, those messages, those phone calls, I mean, I printed out every single one, and I will keep them for the rest of my time, because knowing that I had that kind of impact on people, what more can you hope to accomplish? And, you know, people don't say those things to you all the time. They don't, on a normal basis, be like, hey, I just want to let you know, working here the last 3 years and potentially the next two or three has been really, really great. And this has fundamentally changed my career and my life. And you've been so impactful. Nobody says that to you on a Tuesday. They say it to you at those big milestone moments or departure moments. And so there was a flood of people that currently work there, that formerly worked there. And it was a lot. It was just a lot. And I loved it. And I will cherish it. And again, I did print them all out, and we'll look forward to reading them again and again as the years go by.
Wonderful. And I think, yes, we can be happy and fearful at the same time. And yes, it's, you know, one big soup of life and emotion. So I'm in a process myself, trying to be more compassionate and open to different ideas. And I appreciate that when we talked about politics, You don't claim yourself to be a Democrat, although you supported Joe Biden. And I've been thinking a lot about becoming a purple person. because I am a blue person. My lineage is blue. And I think for my own development and to support and be helpful in conversations, I aspire to be purple. So I do want to go back and have you talk about the things that you felt Trump did well and appreciate him.
Sure. It's interesting. I feel like you and I need to talk now on a more regular cadence, because that is a great notion, a purple person. I'm going to think on that for quite some time, because people always say, oh, are you a Democrat or Republican? To which I say, I'm an American. I'm an American. I have supported Republican candidates with my time and my money, and I have supported Democratic candidates. I've happened to have supported more Democratic candidates, but you know, we'll see how time evolves. I think there are a number of things about the president that we can talk about in a positive way, because I think it's important to not just view everything through such a negative lens. And I could spend much longer talking about negative things, but there was substantive criminal justice reform done by this administration. And the United States leads the world in a number of indicators, but one of them is the percentage of our population that is behind bars. And there is no reason for it. There are reasons for people to be behind bars, but the fact that we have so many people incarcerated for so many things that we do not need to incarcerate people for, the fact that there is such inherent racial bias in that system of incarceration, in what sentences are handed down to different people that look differently in different communities. And so that is a fundamentally wonderful thing that this president did. He got it done. There are things around foreign policy. The Chinese have every right to do a host of things and rise as a nation as they continue to grow economic and military clout around the world. They don't have a right to engage in some of the trade and economic practices that they have engaged in. And the president is 100% correct in taking China to task for being a bad actor in the global economic environment. Now, the way he went and took China to task has been ineffective, but that's a separate conversation. But he has led this conversation. He has fundamentally changed for Democrats and Republicans, because the Biden administration is not going to suddenly go back. But he has fundamentally brought China's inappropriate trade practices, inappropriate economic practices to the forefront of the American political discussion. And there is no going back on that. And I view that as a fundamentally good thing, because there is a beautiful place in a multipolar world where rules-based institutions govern how we interact country to country, where China is a wonderful actor within that system, creating economic prosperity for their people and for people all around the globe, but not by stealing trade secrets and not by doing a lot of things that they were doing. And so those are two unbelievably productive things that President Donald Trump achieved for the American people.
Thank you.
Can I do the other part now? Because that might take the rest of our time.
I'll ask you this, Jeff. What is the biggest problem with Donald Trump and what he's done for this country in the last 4 years?
Hopefully, as most people listen to this, it is no longer a problem, but emblematic of the, to me, fundamental reason this man had to be removed from office is what he is doing right now as we sit on November 11th, 2020. And that is, he is challenging with no evidence whatsoever. And I want to be very clear about that, because every Secretary of State that runs the elections has been very clear that they have found no issues with the vote, with the vote counting or in anything. And he, because he doesn't want to admit that he lost, is causing doubt on the election process. And that is fundamentally why this man cannot be president of the United States, because he's only doing it because he lost, right? If he had won, but if the Republicans had lost the Senate, he wouldn't be doing this. He wouldn't be saying, oh, we need to recount all. He would just say, no, I won, it's all good. And so he has no sense of service to this country, that the institution of the presidency is bigger than him. And that has manifested itself in innumerable ways over the last 4 years. But nothing more powerful and nothing more damaging than him casting any doubt, unless there was real doubt, in which case, by all means, ferret it out. We want free and fair elections. and we want elections that abide by the rule of law. And if there is cheating, the cheating must be rooted out. But there hasn't been anything reported or any evidence. And he sits there and yells and screams that the election is not fair because he didn't win. And that is so damaging to the election process that is so fundamental to this country that I can't think of a better example or a more scary example of why I am super thankful that in 69 days, Joe Biden will be inaugurated as the president of the United States. And if he needs to be removed by the military, so be it. And one nation under the rule of law, where all people are equal under that law, that is fundamental to this country. And it's not something that we've done perfectly as a country, but it's something we should aspire to. And certainly the person we have in charge should be the most selfless and put himself behind the needs of all 335 million Americans.
Thank you. I agree. And honestly, I one of the reasons I have a company called the Compassionate Leader Circle and a podcast called the Compassionate Leader Circles, I wanted to shine a light on people in all sectors that are doing beautiful work, because I feel like a lot of the oxygen, the media oxygen, has been taken away by our current
leader. The least compassionate leader in the history of the world. I mean, yeah.
So I appreciate that as you look forward, you're looking for ways to serve and help. So could you open up a crack of the doors that are in the hallway for you and maybe share a few of them you're pondering?
Of course. So the most important one that I'm pondering, that I will do at some point, I just don't know if it's something I can do right now, is I would argue, Laurel, that the issue or the issues that were really brought to the fore by President Trump, he is a symptom, he's not a cause of these issues. Some of them he is a pure cause of because of the way he chooses to lead. But when I think about the inefficiency of the political organism and its inability to find long-term solutions, whether they're social issues that we are still divided on and we have been for 40 years, whether they are structural issues around how we tax, how we spend, whether they're foreign policy issues, environmental issues, and a host of other things. There are great challenges that exist in the United States. And if we think that the men and women in the room are going to suddenly do something different because they see a higher calling or because we've changed from one president to another, that we're suddenly going to create, we're suddenly going to get long-term solutions, that would be crazy to think that we're going to have a different outcome from the same process. So I would argue that in order to get to more political function, to move away from dysfunction, we need to change the political process. And so I want to found a charity and a PAC that is focused not on Democrats or Republicans, but on any politician that will get behind a series of pillars that are fundamental to reforming the election process. And those things are open or nonpartisan primaries. They are term limits for every elected official. They are mandatory voting. They are election districts being drawn by independent judges. Those, to me, are the fundamental things that need to happen. Because if we have men and women in the room that are not beholden to the 1.5% of an electorate that actually votes in a primary, if we have men and women in a room that know that they only have a limited amount of time in office and therefore they don't need to get reelected, because a lot of politicians will say, I know exactly what I need to do. I just don't know how to get reelected if I do it. Great, let's remove that. If we have politicians that are actually responsive to 50%, not just of the voters, but of the population, because everybody has to vote, I am 100% sure we will have men and women in the room that are coming up with the right long-term solutions, the compromise, middle of the ground, common sense solutions that most Americans believe in. And we will not get those people unless we change the process, because everyone elected will do the exact same thing as everybody that is elected now. They actually, and I've had the opportunity, as I'm sure you have, of interacting with many congresspeople and senators over the years. They're wonderful people. I have very good friends that are Republican congressmen that I don't agree with on many things, but they are so constrained, if they want to keep their jobs and what they have to do, that they will continue to do it no matter how wonderful people they are and no matter how well-intentioned they are. We need to change the process so they have very different incentives. And an organization focused on that, I think, is very needed in the United States right now. And so that is a door that I am looking at. And I will tell you, I'm a little scared, quite frankly, to open it for a host of reasons, but it's one of the doors that I'm looking at.
Fascinating. What do you think of the Electoral College?
I'm okay with the Electoral College. I mean, look, it's not ideal, but it's a very clear, understood way of electing a president. Changing the Electoral College is something that I think will eventually happen, but it to me is not fundamental. It may not be right that Joe Biden will end up winning this election by well over 5 million votes, by nearly 4% of the electorate. And I will say this, I don't think that when all the votes are finally counted and we're all fully done, it will actually not have been as close of an election as people think. Michigan was on a razor's edge on election night. Joe Biden will end up winning Michigan by 3 or 4%. Nevada was on a razor's edge for weeks. Joe Biden will end up winning Nevada by 3 or 4%. And so Arizona and Georgia will be razor's edges when all the final votes are counted and those states will flip, but it wasn't that close. So I'm not that disturbed by the Electoral College. I'd like to see it changed, but to me, that is one election for one person who is term limited. And so I'm not overly concerned about that than I am with the men and women at the local level, the state level, and certainly in Congress that I think need to be fundamentally changed, their incentives and how they get elected.
I think I saw President Clinton talk about this, that sticks with me, is that also often our leaders are sleep deprived, because they're traveling back and forth to Washington and they're fundraising. And they're not really spending, most of their time should be governing and researching and thinking. And they spend a lot of time traveling and fundraising. So I think
the fundraising is also a fundamental problem. I don't know that it's a problem that so skews our ability to get things done. So I would love to see it change. I'd love to see Citizens United reversed. I think the idea that anybody can give money to politicians and we don't know who they are is a fundamental problem. The fact that people can give as literally unlimited amounts to a cause, I think, is a problem. But again, I'm not sure that they so skew the process that those are fundamental reasons why we don't get things done. It might actually be a reason why we do get some things done. Mm. But I wouldn't put that in my list of things that people had to sign up for in order for our organization to back them.
Yeah. Well, I like where you're headed. It sounds very clear. Long-term or short-term, it'll be a problem that needs to be solved. What else are you thinking about? Are you taking a vacation?
Ideally, if not for COVID, I would have a backpack on and I would be off the grid for a couple months. And I hope to still do that once this election was over, but not travel internationally and just make my way around this great country, rent a Winnebago and just go, or just put a backpack on and just start moving. I don't think that is the socially responsible thing to do, even though I am relatively young and certainly healthy and not at any risk. I think it's incumbent upon everybody to do the socially responsible thing over these next few months. And let's not pretend just because, a vaccine got announced that was 90% effective, that it's going to be distributed or this is going to go away anytime soon. We got another, 6-7 months of this. And it's incumbent upon everybody to do their part and to be socially responsible. And well, I'd love to go on some adventures, I don't think that's the appropriate thing to do.
Maybe a staycation in New York, right?
I've had plenty of staycation time, and it's been great. I will tell you, look, as an entrepreneur, you're used to working 18 hours a day, 7 days a week. And so when I got bought by ADP, you know, I took that down. I gave my word that I would still run the company as if they hadn't bought it for a year. And so, I mean, I took it down. I didn't work 18 hours a day every weekend day. I still worked every weekend day. I still put in a lot of time. But over the last year and a half, as other people took over the leadership of Work Market, I've certainly gotten a lot more sleep, and I'm almost caught up, almost ready to say that my body's recovered from that experience. But unfortunately, as you get older, your body doesn't recover as quickly anymore, but not the worst problem to have.
Do you, if in your experience, because you also advise others that have businesses and you've run businesses, do you think entrepreneurs have to work 7 days a week, or is that a choice?
It's a really good question. I would say this. Entrepreneurs start out with a 95 to 99% chance of failure, just statistically. If you're starting a business, you have a 99 to 95% chance that it's not going to work. And the biggest variable in the equation of whether or not it does work is the entrepreneur, is the effort of that person or team of people. And so is it necessary to work 18 hours a day, 7 days a week? Of course not. Are you increasing your probability of being successful? The answer to that question is maybe, as long as you're doing it in a way that you are not burning yourself out, in which case you're super productive, then you're super unproductive, and you would have been better off just working 12 hours a day. So that's obviously an individual choice based on somebody's constitution and what they can handle. For me, at the last startup, I'm not so sure, given now that I'm a little older, it will be the case for the next startup if I go down that road. But for me, it was the appropriate choice to make in terms of increasing the probability, because as a founder, you have responsibilities to the people that have put their career on your shoulders, that have put their money on your shoulders, and you owe them every ounce of energy you have. You owe that team, you owe your investors, every ounce of energy you've got. And so for me, the way I felt comfortable knowing that I gave every measure was literally by physically giving every measure. I'm not saying that's for everybody, but it did work for me. And for me, that felt like the right trade-off, and I could handle it from a time standpoint. So is it for everybody? Probably not. But whatever you can do to increase the probability of success is incumbent upon that entrepreneur to do, because you're doing it not for yourself, you're doing it for a whole host of other people.
So let's go to your second book.
Ah. The book that I was actually qualified to write.
Tell me about the process of deciding to write it and then writing it and then launching it this year.
So the reason, Laurel, that I wrote the book is I got very frustrated as somebody going to conferences and being on panels and giving talks. You know, you're obviously there, you listen to what other experts have to say, and people would make predictions about the future of work that I didn't understand, because they weren't based on three very important things: the history of work, the data available to us in the world of work, and how companies actually engage workers. And I can give you a host of examples on that. Two very powerful ones come to mind for me. One is, when I started Work Market, there was a general statement in the world of work that 50% of the US labor force was going to work in an on-demand capacity in 2020. And I remember reading that everywhere and thinking, that's ridiculous. That's not remotely going to be true. Like, why are people saying it? And I finally got down to, like, who were the first few people to say it? And it was because the on-demand workforce from 2009 to 2010 had grown by like 3% as we came out of the Great Recession. And everybody took that 3% and just assumed it kept going. I was like, does anybody here know math? Like, this is not intelligent. Like, it was never going to be true. And yet you had people talking about it and experts writing about it and talking and thinking about it, and therefore companies making decisions based on it, and individuals making decisions based for their family based on it, And that is just dangerous, right? It is inherent. It is the responsibility of people making public statements to be able to back those statements up. And so that was the first example. The second is I was fortunate enough to be at the Economist Future of Work panel, and or forum, whatever they called it. And they had me on stage debating, is the gig economy good for workers or bad for workers? And I was debating against a wonderful team of people, very, very smart. And one of them made the statement, well, companies always just hire the cheapest labor source. And that was the crux of the argument against the on-demand economy. And I remember saying to him, I'm like, do you think that CHROs and their entire teams and the rest of the executive committee come together for a labor resource planning meeting and they say, okay, so what should we do? Hire the cheapest people at all costs? Yes, great, meeting adjourned. If that's how you think companies actually engage workers, you know absolutely nothing about how companies work. And it was fundamental to this argument against on-demand workers, that companies would take advantage at all chances they could. Cost is a very clear component, and it's a very, very important component, but it is by far not the only component. And so those two experiences stuck in my mind for a very long time, and I thought, you know what? I need to write a book that looks very closely at the history of work, that does a very, very deep dive on the data available in the world of work, and that talks and researches how companies are actually doing labor resource planning, how they're really transforming their labor forces. Because if we understand those, I'm not saying that if we understand those three perfectly, we are able to perfectly predict the future. I would never make that statement. I would say that we have a much higher probability of making statements that have a reasonable degree of turning out to be true. And if they're not true, they will only need not true by a degree or two. They're not going to be fundamentally off the way that 50% by 2020 was fundamentally incorrect, in as much as the on-demand labor force grew about 3% over that 10-year period, they took about 3% market share. They were about 25 to 27% of the labor force, and now they're about 28 to 30% of the labor force. And that was what was always going to happen. And so it was, for me, a very important journey and a very, very interesting one, but it did take me 7 years to do.
And what do you want people to get from the book, your readers?
I would love people to understand that they should be wary. Anytime they hear a prediction of the future of anything, quite frankly, be wary. A lot of people hear an expert say, oh, you know, we'll be on Mars by this date. Okay, maybe, but what goes into it? And for people to be inquisitive, and in the world of work, I would say that questioning, that inquisitive nature starts with history, data, and how companies engage workers. And then going to Mars, it involves jet propulsion and a thousand other things. But be inquisitive and be very wary when people make predictions outside of the data sets or the bodies of evidence available in that area.
Great. So some of our listeners and some of the people I work with fall into two categories. And since we have an expert on the future of work and the presence of work, I'd love any advice you have for two groups. One group being young people entering the workforce now, and older workers who have lost their job or just have lost their will for political corporate machine. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's start with the easier of those two, and that is people just entering the labor force. I will make the statement that I don't think is a controversial statement at this point. It was somewhat controversial the first few times I made it, which is every company is a technology company. And people are like, oh, the tech companies. No, every company is a tech company. And I tell my nieces and nephews, learn how to code. Now, does that mean you're going to become a software engineer? Not necessarily, but understand software language, understand data architectures and analytics and things of that nature. So that way you are not shut out of those conversations. You're able to at least be engaged and have enough to be literate. And you will be all the more so if you've got an educational foundation in it, whether it's in school or, you know, in your own time. So those jobs are fundamentally growing when we think about the hard tech jobs, the software engineers and data and robotics and AI and cybersecurity and a host of other things. Those jobs are growing by leaps and bounds. And so if you want great job security, go hard tech. Easy advice to give, right? Tons of data to support it, no question. The other thing people don't, I think, appreciate as much, and this may get into kind of your worker that has been in the workforce longer, is hard human. The hard human jobs are also growing. And those are jobs that require creativity, design, empathy. Things that those of us that have had a chance to go to these advanced robotic labs and the companies that are building this next generation of robots that are changing the world, the idea that this robot will be able to mimic human interactions in a healthcare environment, in a sales environment, in a customer support environment is laughable. They are so far away from being able to do something that you actually would feel like you're speaking to a human or interacting with a human. And the idea that you're going to one day only be interacting with machines, AI, bots or whatever, it's just not going to happen in the next 20 years. You know, 30, 40 years, maybe, who knows? Science, can't stop science. But those hard human jobs are actually also jobs that are predicted by every place that does prediction on job growth to grow. There are jobs to avoid, and those jobs usually involve the words repetitive high volume tasks. When we look throughout history, any job that has a very large part of its component tasks that are repetitive high volume tasks, just think about on a manufacturing line. I just put a bolt in here, I put a bolt in here, I put a bolt in here. If that's your job, as history has shown us, that job does go away. A machine puts a bolt in, puts a bolt in, puts a bolt in. And so whether it's data entry or some retail jobs, those jobs are going to go. But there are plenty of other jobs, more jobs, in fact, that will grow. And so when I think about, not to kind of jump to another question, but this is always where this series of statements goes, the doom of robots and AI, Laurel, is not robots and AI systems taking jobs from humans. That's not the doom. Although, you know, 10 to 15% of jobs will be taken over the next 20 years, and that's a lot. It's 25 million jobs in the United States. We will create more than 25 million jobs in those other fields. The doom of the robots is exacerbating existing gaps in society, because we don't do the retraining necessary to move people from the jobs that are dying to the jobs that are growing. And historically, societies have done a very poor job of this. And historically, those workers that are left behind tend not to be too happy and tend to have a lot of societal, you know, issues, whatever the right term is, right? They are disruptive to society, whether that's increased crime rates, in some cases revolutions, when we look at different societies throughout history, whether it's they vote a certain way for nationalist or populist policies, they are things that are fundamentally not good for society as a whole. And I will hope that we learn that lesson from history, that we as a society should not leave these workers behind. We should provide the infrastructure and the incentives for retraining, because we can move them from jobs and industries and geographies that are not growing to the jobs, industries, and geographies that are growing.
Fantastic. What would you say to older workers? The same thing? Do they need to learn to code?
I would say this. I think that there is a very powerful trend coming where companies stay engaged with their retirees. And if you do not work for a company that has an alumni program, encourage your company to start an alumni program. It is one of those near-term trends that I predict in the book that hasn't taken off yet. And it is mind-blowing to me how this has not taken off yet. But pre-COVID, companies were experiencing tremendous skills gaps on customer knowledge, on process knowledge, on institutional knowledge, and they were letting all of those skills walk out the door every day and maybe move jobs, but maybe retire. And so make sure that your company has an alumni program. and make sure that you stay in touch with the companies that you've worked with before. So there are a lot of opportunities from that construct. I would also say that people view the on-demand economy as a millennial thing. The biggest employment gap or gap, the biggest employment group in the on-demand economy are older workers. And the on-demand economy does not mean Uber drivers, right? It means people doing gig assignments for companies. So make sure that you are on these gig economy platforms, the Upworks of the world, the business talent groups, the Catalans of the world, the Fivers of the world, to go and get these gig assignments for a marketing project, a analytics project, a consulting project that are out there that your skills may well be perfectly aligned for, and there might be great opportunities there for incremental income.
Jeff Wald, it's been a pleasure having you today. President-elect Biden, if you're out there, I think I found your Secretary of Labor. So that's what I'm gonna hawk. I also so appreciate what you said about all businesses being technical businesses or technology companies. My father, who was an IBMer, said that to me 20 years ago. And I was like, oh, Dad. And I had to go back and apologize to him. And I'll be spending Thanksgiving with him and reminding him of how smart he is. He'll enjoy that. Go to Amazon and buy Jeff's book, The End of Jobs. Is there anything else you want our listeners to know?
I would finish with this, which is, I think that there's also a wonderful series of movements going on in the world of work, and I think in personal development around wellness. And whether it's a short meditation before a meeting or putting on your calendar to remember just to take 5 minutes and listen to a little meditation app, or just take 5 minutes and just breathe. There are innumerable studies that show this is nothing but an amazing, amazing thing. It is one of those things called a robust finding in the world of medicine, meaning there is not a single study that says it's negative. You know, sometimes coffee is good for you, then coffee is bad for you. Meditation is good for you in every way, shape, and form. And much like people exercise their body, I think very shortly you will see everybody exercise their mind, and it's just a regular basis. And there's no reason that your leader, your listeners shouldn't be at the forefront of that curve. They probably are already. And I think it helps everybody to be more compassionate, not only with your team, with your company, with your, you know, your customers, but importantly with yourself. And so I couldn't be more impressed with everything I've read on your site and listened to from your work. And I think there's a lot of great work still to be done here, which gives me a lot of hope.
Thank you so much. Have a good evening.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Compassionate Leaders Podcast. You can learn more about us at CompassionateLeadersCircle.com. Please join us each week as we shine a light on compassionate leaders making a positive impact on their communities and the world.